You are listening to the Sand and Snow Podcast, a Game of Thrones podcast where we talk about all the weekly goings-ons in the world of Westeros and beyond. Join me, Hyle Snow, and Jade Sand as we recap and review every episode of the hit HBO series, all while comparing it to George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, as well as other fantasy genre and historical stories. Now, fill up a glass of mead, cuddle up with your favorite dragon, and enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sand and Snow Podcast, a Game of Thrones podcast. I am Hyle Snow. I am exclusively a fan of Game of Thrones through the television series.
And I'm Jade Sand, and I'm a fan of the books as well as the TV series.
And we are gathering together this week to talk about the most recent episode, Season 4, Episode 6, titled The Laws of Gods and Men. And just to give you guys a quick recap on how we do things here, we're going to be talking about everything on the show, all the way up to the episode I just told you about, as well as anything that happened in the books. So if you don't want to have any of that stuff spoiled, probably should avoid this for now. But if you like hearing us talk about the show and the books, feel free to enjoy it. But beware, this podcast is dark. And full of spoilers. Yes, indeed. So, the Laws of Gods and Men has happened this week. The beginning of the trial for Tyrion Lannister and a few other interesting developments, I think, have happened.
Yeah, definitely.
Things are progressing quite nicely for Season 4. We're seeing Daenerys finally reach her hardships that we thought things were going too easy for her. Now we're finally seeing, nope, not so much. Finally, yeah. Things are going to start biting her in the back.
Yeah.
We're seeing further what the roles for Oberyn Martell and Mace Tyrell are.
Yes.
And what else are we seeing here this week?
I don't know. What are we seeing?
Okay. Well, let's not just beat around the bush then. Let's just go ahead right into the intro and run down it. We have our intro featuring King's Landing, Dreadfort, Winterfell, the Wall. What's this? Is this a new city? Bravos.
Oh.
Hell yeah.
Hell awesome.
And not only did it was it a new city? It just looks so awesome in this opening.
Oh my god, I was so excited to see it in the intro.
There was this
so pumped
coin that
was rolling around.
Like almost like those things you see at Walmart where you drop a coin and it rolls around in a circle, all awesome.
Yeah.
And then the statue.
Yeah.
Now,
the Titan.
Can we talk about the Titan for a second? Because we also see this in our opening scene of the show. But also Marine is there too. But we'll get to Marine later. But jumping into the opening scene, we see Stannis and Davos sailing on a ship. Stannis looking like the grumpy cat. The cat who never smiles.
Yeah, I know.
Just sitting there with this frown on his face. He can't be happy about anything. Salt.
Yeah.
They sail under that huge statue going into Braavos. What'd you say the thing was called?
It's the Titan of Braavos. It's like a symbol for the city, and it's on their coins. And when any ships come near, a loud blast is let out.
It farts?
No. Oh,
wait. So wait, is it alive?
No, no. Not that I know. I mean, like, I guess you never know. No, it's just a bronze. It's like a big bronze statue. So basically, to warn the arsenal when anyone comes in, there's a loud blast coming from the Titan.
So there's probably like onlookers in the head or something like that.
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I guess, you know,
it's not the.
So it's sort of like the people who man the top of the wall.
Yeah,
and
it's not
an
like the.
Out.
Yeah, it's not like the statue, like, you know, farts when anyone comes.
Well, this is a mystical world. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Okay, but
maybe that's the thing that's going to save us from the dragons. Like the dragon gets fully grown and all of a sudden the statue of Braavos comes alive and chops them down.
Right, like Godzilla.
Yeah. Yeah, this turns into Pacific Rim. And Bran is the only one. Like he has to warg into the statue to go against the dragons. Oh my gosh, this is all coming together so nicely.
yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally plausible theory. But yeah, I mean, other than that, I feel like there must be more to the Titan than that, but right now I don't know anything else about the Titan.
Okay.
But it is one of the 9 man-made wonders of the world, quote-unquote.
So they have 9 wonders of the world in the world of Westeros.
Yeah.
Can
well, not down? Not just Westeros, because that's in Essos, but the entire world.
What's the world called?
I don't know if I've ever heard them refer to the Earth.
I remember reading it somewhere, but it was some weird name I've never heard them actually reference.
Yeah, so I can't remember any, you know, if someone has said
Someone will correct us out there, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know. but anyway, it's one of the 9 man-made wonders.
What are some of the other ones?
I don't know other than the Wall. The Wall is man-made, but I can't, and actually, I believe someone from the Stark family is one of the, is the guy who made the wall. I forget his first name, but he's, you know, so-and-so the builder, and he's well known for building the wall. I can't think of what the other man-made wonders are other than those two.
Okay. Well, another topic for another time then. Stannis and Davos end up inside this large stone room. Yeah. Waiting for the clerks, I guess you would call them, from the Iron Bank.
They're bankers. Now, this scene actually comes from a preview chapter for the sixth book.
So this is, again, we're delving into territory that has not happened.
This is something that George R.R. Martin put up on his website, and it happens differently, but it's the same basic concept. And what you have to know about the Iron Throne is that, Freudian slip. What you have to know about the Iron Bank is that all the free cities, including Braavos, have banks, but theirs is, you know, the biggest and most powerful. Whenever a prince or a king or royal figurehead comes into default with their debts, the Iron Bank, what will happen is the Iron Bank will use its money to support someone who will then conquer and replace that king or whoever.
So I was kind of wondering how they what exactly their threat is. Do they have an army? Do they have a monster? Do they have the Titan? Is that what they use to get their
I don't know. In fact, they don't really like go into that kind of detail, except for the fact that they do have enough money to support anyone who wants to overthrow the throne. So they will. They're known for supporting whoever wants to, you know, basically say like, okay, well, let me borrow this money. I'll take over the throne. I'll pay you back that money plus the crown's debt. So they're known for doing that. So that's like, you know, that's a big threat.
Now, was that in any way part of Robert's rebellion?
Actually, I think that Robert was motivated like by... No.
Tywin has his connections with them. So maybe Tywin could have worked a way to get Robert in there.
It could have been. I don't know if that actually was a factor now that I think about it. But if it was... I don't remember it being mentioned explicitly. I really don't think that it was, because up until about this book, not even this book, the Iron Bank is like very rarely mentioned. But the Iron Bank is known for supporting anyone who wants to replace their debtors, which means that Stannis realizes that he can come to the Iron Bank, and he has this goal of wanting to overtake the throne. And he is trying to tell them, you know, look, if you give me a little money, I can go and overtake the throne, pay you back, plus the debt of the crown.
But he's initially turned down, though.
Yeah, of course.
Stannis' argument was not good enough. But Davos comes to bat for him.
Oh, yeah.
Davos is able to convince him. Davos with his chopped hand, which I think is the first time we've seen that.
Yes.
By Stannis himself, he said it was given to him.
Yeah, it is. You know about the story about how his fingers were taken, right?
Do we?
Yeah, I believe it was mentioned in like the first or second season.
Hmm.
Davos was a smuggler when it's a long story, but basically Stannis has to punish him for smuggling. And so even though Davos was helping him out, Stannis chopped off his fingers as punishment. So Davos's point is that Stannis is fair. And Stannis, you know, pays his dues, basically. So that seems to sway the Iron Bank.
From what we see, we don't see them get an official... Well, actually, we do kind of see that they're officially giving
it to
they're
him. Basically giving the head nods.
Because the next scene, we find Salamander Sam. I don't know what his official name was.
Salador San.
he's in a hot tub with a few whores. Davos enters and interrupts him and slaps down a big bag of golden dragons, telling him that they'll be setting sail in the morning. So, obviously, they must have gotten their money if Davos just walks in dropping that kind of coin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that they totally skipped ahead to this preview chapter of the sixth book. I'm wondering what they're doing with that.
I'm wondering whatever happened to them caring about the problem at the north.
Yeah, I am too.
And where's Melisandre been? Because we haven't seen her at all in the last number of episodes.
Believe me, I'm wondering the same exact thing. So... You know, I don't know why they skipped ahead to this. I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Well, we head out to Yara, actually. Yara, we haven't seen, gosh, I feel like since it was last season was last time we saw Yara, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it was. When they received Theon's dick in a box.
Dick in a box?
Yeah.
She's reading the notice that said all Ironborn were to remove themselves from the north. I'm guessing that's involved with the whole thing with Moat Cailin. Wanting them to remove themselves from Moat Cailin.
Yeah. Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Ramsay thinks he's a badass, basically.
Well, Yara's giving her big motivational speech about how they need to free Theon, their prince.
Yeah, which is something she does often. She's good at that, and her men respect her, and, you know.
So that must be a thing for the Ironborn, because we also saw that with Theon, where he was trying to make this big motivational speech, and they were
getting all into it
right before they knocked
him. Yeah, because, I mean, they think of him as just, they don't even think of him as being a Greyjoy, you know. So, Yara totally has the respect of her men. So, yeah, she gives this nice motivational speech. This doesn't happen in the books at all, by the way.
This whole thing that we're about to go into. Okay, well, they get to the Dreadfort. They breach the castle. One of the squires brings them to where Theon is, locked up inside with a bunch of dogs.
Yep,
the bitches. I know you made you a little happy to see.
Yeah,
you're
it
like,
is.
You always think they're going to forget these little details out of the book, and then they bring them in.
And they do. Yeah, I'm so happy. It warms my heart. Yeah, I was cool to see that scene. I pictured it differently in the books. I don't know if it's because it was described differently, but in the books, I actually imagined it even worse, where it's like a dark dungeon, no fire, no light, nothing. That's really tough to film in, though.
That's probably the only reason they went that
direction. I know. It's like even more miserable than it looks there, you know. And the first time you actually see Theon for a very long time, he happens to have caught a rat, and he's like quickly trying to eat it before anyone finds him because he's starving, and he's like
savoring
it.
Now that would
have
been cool for them to have.
Yeah. I would have appreciated that, but you know, whatever. They did show him with Ramsay's bitches, which, you know, was good enough.
Well, Theon refuses to be saved. He's scared of seeing Yara there to save him. He thinks this is all just another test. He thinks Ramsay's testing him once again, and if he tries to play along, it's going to end up with more pain for him, which that's all he cares about anymore, is avoiding the pain.
Like I mentioned a couple episodes ago that the whole time that Theon has been away, Ramsay has been conditioning him, playing these games with him where he tortures him and treats him like shit. And then he pretends that Theon has a way to escape, and Theon takes the bait, and then Ramsay punishes him for it by cutting off, you know, a toe or a finger, you know, or his other appendages. Mm. And yeah, so now he is completely brainwashed. And I think that the only reason why they got into this scene is because you don't understand that without seeing this scene. So this doesn't happen in the book.
Yeah, because you were saying, like, they cut to little instances of that many times throughout the book. And in the show, they've only had, like, maybe two or three things that could even be slightly related to that.
Yeah, because it's...
And at that point, it even felt like overkill for that story in the show.
Yeah.
So this was very pivotal for getting that feeling across.
Yeah, exactly, because... From the books, it's clear. Theon, you have a monologue coming from Theon. He's talking. It's, you know, what he's thinking in his head. So you get that impression right off the bat. In the show, it's hard to do that. So this was the perfect way to do that. So even though this doesn't actually happen, it was the only way to show, I guess, that Theon's completely brainwashed. Even after he sees his sister standing right there trying to take him away, he bites her and doesn't let her take him away, which, you know, is like crazy.
Well, we actually, during Yara's speech, she was saying before, we get these little cuts in of Ramsay playing with his plaything.
Yeah.
Whatever the heck her name was. Was it?
I can't remember.
Something like that. One who shot the girl at the beginning of that episode.
Yeah,
earlier.
Exactly.
When he comes into the scene later to meet Yara trying to break out Theon, he's just covered in scratches and blood all over him, which is hilarious because I remembered seeing that during the previews last week.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, Ramsay must be in some big battle or something like that coming out looking like that. No, he was just coming from wild kinky sex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I almost expected that when I saw the preview. I don't know. I would expect that of him.
Ramsay threatens to release the bitches on Yara. And Yara and her soldiers just run away, which I don't get. Are they really afraid of dogs?
No, I don't think that. When the battle is over, not that the bitches aren't fierce, but Yara realizes that she's not going to convince her brother to come with her. And she's just like, she's basically just like, oh, he's dead to me. But again, I mean, I feel like they could have handled that better. You know,
it just made them seem there wimpy. Could have been, like, they went through all this, and now they're going to run away from a couple dogs?
I think that, like, it's not believable to me that she would just do that.
She just heartlessly slit the throat of that squire boy after he went along with everything she asked for.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of gave this impression like she was fed up and she just was like, you know, basically, this is no brother of mine. I'm just going to leave him. And, you know, he's a lost cause. Hmm. But I don't really think it's believable that she would do that. I think that she would, you know, try to kick everyone's ass. But if she does, you know, she can't kick Ramsay's ass because he's an important character. You know, so this scene was kind of important.
Because that power exists in the world of stories.
Yeah, I know.
No bad things will come to you if you're important to the story later on.
I know. Like Ned Stark, right? He's cool. He's fine now, right? But anyway, yeah, it wasn't that believable. But it was the show's way of showing how tortured Theon was and what his mindset is right now.
Well, immediately after that, we get an interesting scene where Ramsay presents Theon with a gift for his loyalty, a bath.
Yeah.
Not just anybody, but he's going to give him the bath himself, like rub him off with a washcloth and everything.
Oh my God. It's totally psycho.
Totally uncomfortable.
When I saw it, all I could think to myself was, wow, you know, he gave up the convenience of being with his family to just having one bath. Not that he knows that consciously, but that's what it amounts to. Mm-hmm. Because what he thinks is that this is all part of Ramsay's game. And if he would have gone along with his sister, she would have turned around and been like, oh, just kidding, I'm working for Ramsay. You know, it shows you like how fucked up he is about Ramsay. And then Ramsay asks him to take off all his clothes, almost to like poke fun at him and show how inferior he is because now he has no manhood. And then Ramsay washes him and asks him if he loves him, and it's like so crazy.
So I was reading this really interesting study that was about whether people would be able to survive the ailments that they receive in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And one of them they were going into was Theon.
Yeah.
Having his cock cut off.
Yeah.
Now, they're actually saying that he would be very likely not to survive, not necessarily because of the cut, but because he only cut off his penis and not his balls.
Yeah.
And that his desires, because they didn't have the balls cut off, would still exist, and he would be likely driven insane
from that. Yeah, isn't that crazy? That's nuts.
Nah.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even mean, no pun intended, but that was pretty funny.
Yeah. You had balls to make that joke.
Yeah. That's nuts.
Ba-dum-tsh. Ramsay asks a favor of Reek to pretend to be Theon Greyjoy. I can only assume this once again is going to be playing further into this whole Moat Cailin situation.
You'll see how that comes into play. But yeah, basically, you remember that Roose Bolton kind of slapped Ramsay on the wrist for fucking up Theon because he was going to use Theon as a hostage. Yeah, a bard, right. Well, kind of like a reverse bard because he was a bard and now he's being returned. But anyway.
What? A barter.
Oh, I thought you said bard. Okay. But anyhow, so now, Reek has to be presented as Theon for some purpose that you'll come to know soon.
Okay. Well, we head to a random field where we see a shepherd, his son, and a bunch of goats just grazing around doing goat business. But they're interrupted by a mighty dragon who decides, nope, fuck your shit, and flames him, grabs one of the goats in its hind claws, and just flies off into the distance. This was glorious.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Great dragon scene. There's the red one. I'm sure
Drogon.
Drogon.
He's black and red like Valyrian steel. Well, like Valyrian steel is supposed to be.
He's the one who's essentially set up as the alpha
biggest
dragon.
The strongest, yeah. He seems to be the most powerful. And he's always the biggest. He always grows a bit bigger than the others.
We head into Meereen, where we see Daenerys sitting on her throne, seeing her subjects one by one by one, the tedious work of being the king or the queen in her case.
Yes.
That very same shepherd comes in and shows her what her dragons have done. And we see the heartbreak on her face when she realized this man was one of her supporters, and now her wild dragons have hurt him, one of her subjects.
Yeah.
But she seeks to repay him, and she does so by giving him 3 times the value of his goats. So, situation handled. Daenerys showing that she wants to do the best she can for her subjects.
Yeah.
And we got to see a cool dragon scene out of it.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's all taken care of.
Yeah.
The next one, however, is a little more complicated.
Yeah.
We have a nobleman enter in his tokar, his fancy Meereenian outfit. Meereenese. Is that
Meereenese,
what
I think? He actually says that in the scene. Yeah.
He seeks to have his father taken down from one of the crucifixes that Daenerys put up. He was one of the men that she did in that, and he's building this whole case about how he was innocent, he spoke out against the children crucifixions that they did, and that he was a good man, and that he was just a son wanting to get his father buried the proper way.
Yeah. You can't see me, but I'm rolling my eyes so hard right now.
You are.
Because I just, it's total bullshit.
Well,
something
was very disingenuous from the guy from the whole time.
I know.
I mean, he definitely seemed like he was heartbroken for his father, but I don't think his father was innocent.
I mean, it's like you can't know one way or the other because you
weren't
there.
Well, I'll tell you how I do know. At the very end of when they both were finished talking to Daenerys, the shepherd was very grateful, and when he was leaving, he never turned his back. He just backed away, as people do when they leave a king or a queen.
Yes.
This guy, he got his request. He took 1 or 2 steps back while keeping his back, you know, away from her, and then swiftly turned around and walked out.
Yeah, I feel that may have just been because he is noble and feels that he doesn't have to show that sort of humility in front of her.
Mm.
But in general, his Darza Larak is like, I feel like he's total bullshit. He's got this royal bloodline.
Now, I notice that you're knowing this guy by name. Is this guy going to be significant for us?
Well, I mean, I think it's kind of obvious that he will be, you know, but I don't want to say anything more than that.
That's fine. No, I'm just saying he's going to be a player for Daenerys as she's in Meereen.
Yeah. Yeah. His Dar.
Okay. We head over to King's Landing, where we're at a small council meeting. And this is not too much to go out of this, but more character development of what their positions are going to be here. Like I was saying before, Oberyn was definitely the king of the scene. Just witty, awesome lines left and right throughout
I love Oberyn Martell.
The big thing they're talking about is how they still see Daenerys Targaryen as a threat, which they certainly should. She's grown significantly since the last time they've really talked about her, which was between Ned and Robert. Was last time they really deliberated anything about Daenerys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now she's got so much more. She's got 2 generals. She's got dragons. She's got the Unsullied.
Yeah.
Oberyn making a really good quip about the Unsullied, actually saying that they're very impressive on the battlefield, less so in the bedroom.
Yeah, that was a good one.
One of the great, great lines that Oberyn kept putting out there.
Yeah.
Mace Tyrell being made very obvious that he's just going to be the bitch of this crew, just fetching coffee for Tywin whenever he wants it.
Yeah, he's totally kissing Tywin's ass.
And I like when he asks him to fetch, I think it was a quill or something like that, he gets up and he does it with like such a snooty looking attitude. Like he sticks his nose up and he's walking all puffy chest. Like, oh, he asked me to do it.
Yeah, he's taking it so seriously. In the books, at this point, I don't think that he's an official member of the small council, but he does vie for the position. And
he's really defensive about being the master of ships.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't happen like that in the books. I can't remember him being the master of ships, but at some point he does vie to be a member of the small council. He's not that much of a bitch in the books. But he still is like...
Man, he's been a bitch from when we first met him. When he came up and he was going to talk to Tywin and And he's like, not now. The adults are talking.
Yeah, I know. He's not that much of a bitch in the books. Basically, there's someone else kind of like pulling the strings in the Tyrell family, but he's going along with it.
So the Tyrells and the Lannisters have a lot of similarities.
Yeah, I would say so. Except that I guess that Mace Tyrell is a bit more rational and sometimes uses his wits more than certain Lannister family members, if you were to think of the equivalent. But otherwise, it's basically the same. But yeah, he's not that much of a bitch in the books.
Well, we head to the Iron Throne Room.
No. Hold, back up.
Okay, good.
Back up. Pycelle brings up the fact that Jorah was once, quote-unquote, spying on Daenerys for them. This goes back to...
This goes back?
This does go back. There's a... Shut up. There's a small story behind this.
Okay.
Jorah Mormont, first of all, Jorah Mormont, you know, is
his father.
Is his father.
Was the father of the Night's Watch, now deceased.
Yeah, yes. So the reason why Jorah actually went up to the wall was to allow Jorah to become his heir on Bear Island. At some point, Jorah marries this woman, Lyanna Hightower. And she's spoiled. She has expensive taste. They marry for love. But when she gets to Bear Island, she's miserable and she's used to being, you know, lavished with expensive things.
So wait, it's not Bear, like, rar? It's Bear as in, like, there's nothing there?
No, it really is Bear, B-E-A-R.
Okay.
But it's still kind of a miserable place, and Jorah is not made of gold, you know? She comes from a rich family. He comes from a noble family, but they're, you know, they're not loaded. So anyway, she marries him for love, but while they're there, she starts to become miserable because she's, you know, she's so spoiled
brat. She likes the finer things.
Yeah. So in order to try to make her happy, Jorah turns to getting involved with slave trade in the East, and it's strictly forbidden in the West. And at some point, Ned Stark finds out. And just as he is heading over to Bear Island to... execute Jorah. Jorah has already fled with his wife to the East. And while he's out there, he sells his services as a sellsword in order to try to make money. And she's still whining about, you know, not living a lavish lifestyle, basically. So at one point, while he's out doing his thing as a sellsword, she starts to have an affair with someone. And when Jorah comes back, her lover says to Jorah that basically if... And she's running up all kinds of debts while he's gone, too, because she just likes to spend money. And when he returns, her lover says to Jorah, "You're going to be enslaved for her debts if you don't leave her behind and leave the city." So he does. He really doesn't have any choice. And she has a lover, so there's no point. So at some point, Jorah finds himself basically with Daenerys Targaryen. Well, really, he finds himself with Viserys at this point. And Viserys makes it known that he is trying to make his way to the Iron Throne.
Was it Viserys? Because in the show, they had him originally with the Horde. The Dothraki Horde.
Well, yeah, but he does meet him. He meets Viserys.
Goes into Viserys. Okay,
yeah, exactly. He meets them, I guess, like while they're with the Horde at some point.
Okay.
But yeah, he comes across Viserys and he sees this opportunity to try to get a royal pardon back to Westeros because he knows that if he lets Robert Baratheon, who's the king, he knows is the king at the time. If he lets Robert know about Daenerys' moves, then, you know, they would see that as helpful and he would probably get a royal pardon. So somehow he is in contact with Varys' birds and he starts to relay information to them and it makes it back to Varys and this makes it its way up to Robert Baratheon. At some point, he's been giving enough information about Daenerys' moves to receive a royal pardon. But at this point, he's fallen in love with Daenerys and deeply respects her. You've seen in that scene where they're in Karth and he tells Daenerys about how he's never, you know, he hasn't seen a queen like her in so long and how great she is. It's because he's, you know, falling in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
So, even though he has this royal pardon and can come back at any time, he decides not to. And he actually receives word. Do you remember when the wine merchant tries to kill Daenerys?
Yes.
Because Robert Baratheon sent out a message that anyone who is successful in assassinating her will receive a lordship. And Jorah Mormont knows about this, and that's really how he's able to stop this wine merchant, because he's like on the, he is, you know, privy to this, so he figures it out and saves her. And so he goes along with Daenerys, and while they're in Qarth, they meet someone named Arstan Whitebeard, who's really Barristan Selmy. But, you know, if you show this guy Arstan Whitebeard on the show and you see that it's Barristan Selmy, it's, you know, that's not really, you can't pull off them like, you
know. Well, I mean, why not be Barristan Selmy? I mean, that name holds a lot of significance, especially like Daenerys. She probably would have heard
of him because, from her father. Because in the book, he's like hiding. He's basically like in hiding. He's just been kicked off of the Kingsguard and he goes to the East. Jorah recognizes him but can't place his finger on it, so he doesn't trust this Arstan Whitebeard, quote unquote. The way that they meet Arstan Whitebeard is kind of the same. They're in Qarth, and a sorrowful man, which is an old guild of assassins in Qarth, tries to assassinate Daenerys with that little scorpion thing that you saw.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. The name of it is, it's a manticore, I found out. Arstan Whitebeard comes and prevents the assassination, just like in the show, except that it's in Qarth. And then when they're in Astapor, he reveals the fact that he's really Barristan Selmy and that Jorah Mormont has been relaying this information to Westeros. But right now, all you see is that Daenerys doesn't have any idea. You know, as you're watching the show, you don't really think about it. But think about how she would feel if she found out that Jorah Mormont has been spying on her and relaying the information.
She said multiple times that he is the most trusted person she has.
Yeah.
The most reliable person, the most loyal, all of that.
And in reality, he is. He's proven that, you know, he saved her and he's stopped relaying this information. He's given up a royal pardon. He could be a lord in Westeros right now. And he's given it all up because he believes in her and he loves her and thinks of her as a great queen. In the show, they don't really make it explicit that he loves her, but in the book, he definitely does. I'm sure that that'll, you know, really come to a head.
I think they have shown it.
Yeah, they have, but in a more subtle way. In the book, it's obvious he's like blatantly.
There's that one specific scene. I think it was in Yunkai, right after she frees the Unsullied and kills all the slavers there.
Yeah.
And you see the smoke clearing, and he walks up to her with this big smile on his face, and she just like walks off like she doesn't even notice he's there, and he's like, oh.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, oh. I know. I think even fans of just the TV show and not the books have realized it too, because you know, I've heard the phrase
friendzoned.
Lord friendzone.
Yeah. And there's that one just before that she got to Meereen, where that one guy was talking trash outside of it.
Yeah.
And they were trying to figure out who was going to fight him.
Yeah.
And when Jorah tries to nominate himself, she's like, no, you are one of my best friends. And
yeah.
You see how it cuts him in his face.
Yeah, like, I know. I know. You're one of my best friends, but just my friend. Yeah. But anyway, so I think viewers of the show are not really thinking about the fact that if she found this out, this would land him in deep shit, but it would. So just, you know.
It also kind of explains a little bit more of the catty attitudes between Jorah Mormont and Barristan Selmy.
Yes.
It's not just like, it's not just jealousy.
They don't
even
trust each other. Anything like
that. There's a genuine knowledge of why they don't trust each other. It's not just a gut feeling.
Yeah, exactly.
There's more to it than that.
Yeah, because I think that the reason why they do that in the show is because they want to show the fact that Ser Barristan Selmy doesn't trust Jorah because he knows what Jorah's up to, but he hasn't said anything to Daenerys. And Jorah, in general, I feel like he thinks that Ser Barristan Selmy might actually tell her, and also that he might not even be sure of Ser Barristan Selmy's motives because he hasn't been around for very long. He just kind of showed up out of nowhere. So I think he's wary of that. Like, you know, what if he's really an agent of the king now? You know, he doesn't really...
Selmy,
yeah.
I've actually had that feeling since he's gone on there. Like, I feel like that whole, what's the word I'm looking for? Dismissal, that public dismissal, could have very likely just been a stage act.
It could have been. There was a very good reason for it, because
Let's not forget, it could have been orchestrated by Cersei. Cersei does think she's so smart and could figure these things out on her own.
It could have, but it would have been like a double orchestration, because she did that because she knew that Ser Barristan Selmy was a threat to her cause. Because she, you know, she knew that Ser Barristan Selmy was interested in seeking the just and truth, you know, rather than just blindly going along with her plans. Mm. So I don't believe that, you know, I don't believe it's like sort of this like double agent thing. I don't think there's some sort of conspiracy. But yeah, you still have to understand that Jorah has every right to think, you know, that maybe his motivations are not that pure. Even if it's not for the crown in the West, you know, why is he there? Why does he care about Daenerys?
And then there's the interesting third wheel, Daario.
Yeah, Daario.
But, we spent enough time talking about Daenerys. She's not even in this episode.
Yeah, she's hardly there, yeah.
We head into the Iron Throne, where we have a really cool little conversation between Varys and Oberyn Martell. Oberyn is trying to peg what Varys' sexual desire is, but completely unable to. It's not boys, not girls.
Yeah.
Well, what the heck is it? Well, Varys admits that he has none.
Yeah.
No interest whatsoever. And because he lacks that desire, he can instead spend his energies focusing on other things.
Yeah.
To which he gives a little glance over to the throne and walks away.
I don't know how I feel about that scene, but the interesting part about it is when you think about everything that's been going on, it does have a lot to do with lust. I mean, Robert's rebellion was all about his lust for Lyanna Stark.
Mm-hmm.
And now the reason why there are rebellers against the throne is because everyone knows, or, you know, most people know, or opposers know, that Cersei's children are bastards by her brother.
Children's of lust.
Children's of lust. Yeah, children's. Children of lust. Children of lust.
I don't think we've made this clear up to this point, by the way. I am on an immense amount of Milk of the Poppy.
Yeah.
So if I'm having slurred speech, or if I'm talking a little loopy this week, please forgive me for that.
Children's. That reminds me of Chef from South Park. When he's referring to one child, he still calls them children.
No, that's a very good point how that's thrown there. I mean, there's a freaking sex scene almost every single episode.
But even the greater motivations of everything that's going on, it has a lot to do with lust.
That's basically been the whole character of Littlefinger.
Mm-hmm.
Just everything surrounding that involves
lust. And I didn't think about that right away, but Littlefinger's motivation in all of this was really for Catelyn Stark. I mean, he has this crazy obsession for Catelyn Stark, even now that she's dead. So I think that that was cool that Varys talked about how, you know, he doesn't let his sexual desires get in the way, because he has no sexual desires.
Well, man, from the first season, I knew there was something off about Littlefinger and Varys.
Yeah.
I knew that they had secret plans to try to take that throne for themselves at some point. Now we're finally starting to see these come off across more.
Well, see, they show Varys looking at the throne. They're trying to make this obvious reference, and I think it's a bit cheesy. And on top of that, it's not like something that Varys explicitly says. It's not even something that Varys hints at in the books, really. I think it was just kind of there for the hype.
Well, I don't know if this scene was in the books, but there was that one scene where Varys and Tyrion were in his room conversing, and it was that one where he had the guy who cut his junk in the box.
Yeah.
Was that in the books? Because I feel like in that scene was where he talked about how he has this hunger for power and how he started from nothing and has built himself up, and he's not going to rest until he's at the top.
Yeah, and Varys has also talked about how he does everything for the good of the realm and blah, blah, blah. But my impression is still not that he necessarily seeks the throne. He wouldn't have any heirs. I think, you know...
But he'd be dead. Why would he care at that point?
Yeah, I know.
He only cares about the power that he has in this life.
That's true, but I'd never got the impression that he really sought power just for the sake of power. I think, I feel like he's a bit more wise than that. That's the impression that I get from his character, from, you know, reading about him. But, in the show, they're trying to convey him as being, like, Littlefinger. And I don't get that impression about him, but, you know, whatever.
Well, something that's still sticking in the back of my mind is from the royal wedding, when he was the guy sitting there not clapping when they were talking about donating all the food to the needy. That one moment is still sticking in the back of my head, as little as that may have been.
It's stuck there. I mean,
it's not going away.
I know. I thought about it, but he also wasn't laughing when Joffrey had that show either, and he had a very stern look on his face. And I don't know how I feel about that, because really his emotions in regard to those subjects are not really delved into that much into the books. But again, my overall impression is just that he's not like power hungry like they're trying to make him out to be.
Well, I still thought it was a really cool scene.
Yeah, it still is.
Two personalities that I don't think we have seen have a one-on-one conversation yet.
Yeah.
This could have been the meeting of them for all I know.
Oberyn and Varys, yeah.
I think it's good to throw a few more possibilities into this fight for the throne.
Yeah.
Because that is what this is supposed to be. It's the Game of Thrones. We're trying to see who's going to take that in the end.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people that we had in the beginning are dead now.
Yeah.
So even if they're small contenders, I think you got to throw a couple more names peppered out there as people we have to watch out for, besides the big people who already have their castles and their ships and all that.
And as people are being picked off, you have more people thinking, well, look, this is my opportunity. You know, so there's that too.
That's pretty much Littlefinger to a T. Waiting for that right moment.
Yeah, I know.
He waited for that moment.
I know, and he orchestrated a lot of this, so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he were vying for the throne.
All right, well, it's time.
For the trial.
Jaime heading down to the dungeons to retrieve Tyrion to begin the trial.
Mm-hmm.
We have Jaime bring Tyrion into the throne room, where we first see King Tommen removing himself from it, I guess because he's just supposed to be too young, but we all know it's because someone higher than him is really playing control on this.
No, what he's trying to say is like, of course, it's because someone else needs to take over, being, you know, that person being Tywin. But Tommen is trying to say that he would be like biased because of almost like because of the love of his uncle, you know, whatever, even though he doesn't really know his uncle that well. But yeah, so he recuses himself. And yet Tywin is allowed to sit in on the trial, even though that's Tyrion's own father.
And he hates him.
Yeah.
He's got the opposite feelings that.
I mean, people aren't supposed to know that, but yeah, he hates him. So.
We get a variety of people testifying. Mm-hmm. We get Meryn fucking Trant, Grand Maester Pycelle, Cersei, and Varys all called to the stand to tell their stories.
Yeah, in the books, first of all, I get the impression that the trial, it's not like one trial. It's like this happens a couple times. And every time, I'm not a couple times over, but meaning it happens multiple over sessions. The course of... Yeah, exactly. Okay, there are multiple sessions. So, but, okay... In the show, what happens is people are making true recounts of these stories, but they're just twisting them in a way that makes Tyrion sound bad. Yeah,
they're leaving out certain details.
Yeah.
And Tyrion even calls out Meryn fucking Trant on that.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
Not mentioning how Joffrey was pointing a crossbow at Sansa while those things were said.
But in the books, people are telling blatant lies. They're just totally... lying about Tyrion, saying all this shit about him, how he like threatened to kill the king, and you know, just totally fucking lying. And it's just really ridiculous. It's like this huge farce, and it's obviously wrong, but no one can speak against it. You know, it's just like Cersei has completely orchestrated this whole thing, and it's just like ridiculous.
After all of them go up there, Tywin calls for a short break where we get a little bit of a scene. And I don't know what room this is, but it's Jaime and Tyrion. Tyrion's just sitting there nonchalantly drinking tea or coffee or whatever the heck he's drinking there while Jaime pleads for Tyrion's life. He's saying that this whole trial is a joke. He's saying that this is all obviously being orchestrated against him, like you're saying.
Yes.
Tywin tries to play coy about the situation, but Jaime knows what's up here and he says, listen, I'll do anything. Spare Tyrion's life, and I'll do what you want. I'll go, and I'll be the heir to Casterly Rock. And without a moment's hesitation, Tywin goes, done. Good.
Yeah.
All right. And then he breaks down step by step how it's going to play out over the next few days.
Yep. So in the show, they make it out like Tywin has had this plan all along. But in the books, Jaime doesn't do shit. He doesn't go and plead for Tyrion. You don't even, like, hear about Jaime. And there isn't this whole plan. We'll get to it in a second. But also, the way that the rest of the trial plays out doesn't happen like this. It's a bit different. But I'll get to that when we...
So is this conflict of Jaime having to leave King's Landing to go to Casterly Rock, does that exist in the books, though? Or is that something that they're making up in this?
It's not made up. But, I mean, now it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like...
But, I mean, this is something that was discussed before. It's,
like, vaguely... Yeah,
They've had conflicts between Jaime and Tywin before
this. Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, remember, like I've said before, the point of Jaime becoming a part of the Kingsguard is because it was his and Cersei's plot to get him to stay in King's Landing all the time and be around her all the time and not have to marry. And Tywin has been bitter about it, you know, ever since he's done that, because Aerys Targaryen was totally enthusiastic about him joining the Kingsguard, and Jaime did it without even, like, consulting his father, and now his father doesn't have any heir, and he doesn't want Tyrion to be his heir, because, you know, everyone thinks of Tyrion as being the imp. So this is, in the show, this is Tywin's way of getting back his heir. But it also is kind of weird because at some point he actually offers Jaime Casterly Rock, if you remember, and he refuses. But now it's like Tywin is forcing him into this situation. He thinks, oh, well, Jaime is definitely going to try to ask for Tyrion's life and blah, 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 so I'll do this, you know, whatever. But it's hard to talk about because in the books it doesn't happen like this at all.
How could you have expected Jaime to be the one to barge in there and...
I don't know. Yeah,
like that? That's a lot of expectations to put into a situation like this.
Yeah, in the show, Tywin is... Also in the books, he's a really clever guy. In the show, he's even more clever. Like, he's even more rational and thinking even more ahead and manipulative. So I did expect, you know, I did kind of expect this. And we also show Jaime being much more compassionate towards Tyrion. But in the books, it's like, this doesn't happen, basically.
In general, just great facial acting by Jaime Lannister and Nicolaj Coster-Waldau.
I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but I think his last name is Coster-Waldau, maybe.
Compassion he was begging for Tyrion's life, and then when Tywin just instantly agreed to it, the shock on his face, like, excellent job by him.
Yeah, it was good, yeah. And also, I don't know if you've ever heard him in interviews, but I'm really impressed by how he's able to have control over his accent.
I feel like it pops out Danish, once in a while.
He has a Danish accent.
He does, but I feel like it does pop out once in a while.
Like. I didn't know that he was Danish until I, like, looked into him as an actor. Mm-hmm. I'm totally not, you know, looking at pictures of... Yeah. But, no, that was just, like, a pervy joke. But, he's wiener, hot. What can I say? Wiener, yeah, he's hot. He's like over 6 feet tall. You saw his knight, his like armor at the at the exhibition. He's tall. He's like got this square jaw. He's hot. Anyway,
now he's got scars. Chick stick scars.
Yeah, dude. Oh my god. Anyway, so you know, when looking at interviews of him, I was surprised to see he has a Danish accent. Anyway, I'm just impressed with the fact that he can pull off a convincing English accent like that.
I can't really call it English.
Yeah.
Whatever it would be called in this world. There's no England.
Yeah,
there.
just like Peter Dinklage is putting on an English accent, but it doesn't necessarily have any specific region.
Whatever the heck that Ned Stark used to talk into. He's just a boy.
Yeah. It's like this Irish, Scottish. Yeah, I know. Anyway.
One thing that I was super excited for out of the scene was that we were finally going to see Casterly Rock.
Yeah.
It's one of the few mystical things that we hear about and have not seen yet. We've finally seen the White Walkers. We've seen the dragons. Let's see Casterly Rock.
Yeah, I know.
Let's see.
I think you will.
Has there been any story taking place in there whatsoever in the books up to this point?
Or
has
it just
been
completely avoided? I'm not telling you shit.
I'm not saying the future, but I'm saying up to this point. Is this something they would have normally cut to at any point?
Up to this point, there's been history talked about. I can't remember, like, specific scenes.
But there's never a point. Like, I think even at the beginning of the story, technically Tywin was in Casterly Rock, just they never talked about him.
Yeah, it's not really, like, not significantly. I think they've described it. Mm-hmm. Nothing is coming to mind.
Okay.
So...
Well, I still like to say, I imagine it's a very nice place.
Yes, it is. It is. The descriptions of it are really nice, so...
We head back into the trial. Yeah. Jaime pulls Tyrion aside a little bit to try to tell him what's going on. But before Tyrion really gets a moment to process it, he's introduced to the next person who's going to be testifying, Shay.
Yeah.
His former lover, or whore, whatever you want to refer to her as, I guess.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how people just made up stories that were 100% bullshit.
Yes.
That's where it came from here. She's the one, not a single thing I think she said was really, well... I guess some of
them. She bent the truth a lot, even more than everyone else. Well, I mean, they all did.
Well, some of it was that.
They all made it.
But even the things that she did say were true were just made to look like... she talked about how when they met, he sent a cutthroat to pull her out of someone in the king's service. I'm like, oh, come on.
Total bullshit. So, total bullshit. In the books, first of all, she's almost like... even more oblivious in the books. It's obvious that Cersei has come upon her and is using her in the trial. Either way, in the book and in the show. But in the book, it's almost like she doesn't really give that much of a shit about it. You know, they don't portray her as being in love with Tyrion, but they show that Tyrion's in love with her. And mm-hmm. I think Tyrion knows that she probably is not in love with him. There's a particular scene where, you know, the room where there are all the dragon skulls?
Yes.
I'm pretty certain it's there. They wind up making love in that room, and apparently a little bird of Cersei's, you know, finds out about them because she keeps calling him, oh, my lion, and someone overhears that. And so she's like, forced to say that at the trial, basically. Or she just... offers that information, maybe. Anyway, so in the book, they show her sort of... she almost comes off as like a bimbo, and she's not particularly affectionate towards Tyrion. And in the show, they it's a bit more realistic to me, where they're actually like in love, and there's more powerful emotion behind it. And even though she has to tell these lies for Cersei, she makes them like these nasty, vicious lies because she's obviously really
very
hurt.
Spiteful after the last interaction that her and Tyrion.
Yeah, she's like really... she creates these vicious lies about Tyrion, even though she's forced to.
She looks like she's taking extra joy in it, though, because she knows that
not
she was
necessarily
hurt and now
joy,
she has a chance to return
the... Not thing. Necessarily joy, it's just that I think she sees what the situation is, and she's just like, fuck it, I can't, because she knows that she's done for at this point. Even if, best case scenario, Tyrion, you know, is allowed to go to the wall, whatever. Right now, she knows that Tyrion's fate is lost. She's never going to be with him, and on top of that, she's already been hurt by him. And she can't go anywhere, even though she was offered by Tyrion, you know, a home and a place to stay and whatever in the East. She's probably not going to be able to go anywhere now because Cersei has a hold of her. So I think she's basically just like, fuck it, I'll just like get back at him because...
Well, you think she's in this feeling like if she plays along that she's not going to be let go? Because I imagine that's what it is. If she plays along, they'll let her go.
No. I'm saying that even if she does play along, she's still like Tyrion's ex-whore. What is she going to do? She's going to have to flee. She's not going to be able to be with Tyrion or have like a normal lifestyle.
So that life is gone is what
you're saying. Her life is gone now. I mean, she's not going to be like given a royal pardon or something like that because she's just a whore. And Tywin even made it clear that if he catches Tyrion with any whores, you know, they're like going to be dead and whatever. She's sullied his reputation now, even just by being in the trial. So it's not looking good for her anyway. But anyway, in the books, you know, she's kind of portrayed like a bimbo and she just, you know, doesn't really care that much.
I still think she's kind of a bimbo.
No, I don't. I get the idea that they have this strong bond and this strong love, and she's just put in an unfortunate situation, and now she's hurt by Tyrion. And this cuts him deep, and...
After Shay's story that she tells, this drives Tyrion over the edge.
Yeah.
He loses his mind, and you just see him get these bug eyes. He gets the super frowny face on.
Yeah.
And he ends up lashing his anger out at everybody in the room. If this was... a wrestling scenario, they would call this a heel turn promo.
Yeah.
Where he basically tells the fans to go stick it.
Yeah. Also note that he says, you know, I saved you all. I should have let you all die, whatever. And you also in the show, they haven't really made this explicit that many times, except with his conversation with Varys, I guess. But Tyrion, during the Battle of the Blackwater, had this whole strategy. And
oh, no, they also made that very clear that
yeah,
he was the
okay,
one who
at
did
that
it.
Point.
Like,
yeah.
He went and visited the Pyromancer. He's
Pyromancer. Yeah.
He's the one who took control of placing all that stuff. He's the one who had Bronn ready to shoot the thing.
But also, there was this big chain that he had set in the water at a certain point out into the water away from the shore. And the plan was that when the ships came in close enough, the chain would be lifted to prevent the ships from backing up. And then there would be this this wildfire. And that was Tyrion's idea, the whole thing, Tyrion's idea. And that's why they won. And nobody knows except for Tyrion himself. And it basically, no one's going to give him recognition for it. So yeah, he doesn't say that at the trial either, because he's not like speaking up like that at his trial. But anywho,
he only wanted to speak up to make smart-ass comments rather than things like that. He talks about how he took joy in the death of Joffrey.
Yeah.
Even though he didn't do it, he said he wishes he had.
Yeah.
He enjoyed seeing him die even more than a thousand lying hearts.
Just to be a dick. Yeah, he's doing this just to be a dick.
He cut deep into Cersei. He cut deep into Shay. He cut deep into the entire crowd that was there.
Yeah.
At the end of Tyrion's speech here, he demands the trial by combat, which you can just tell changes the tone in the entire room.
Mm-hmm. There are some intrigued faces. Yeah.
The crowd. Mm. Rabble, rabble, rabble the entire time. Perfect extras that they got for this. They got them dressed nicely the way they got them positioned in the background of the benches.
Yeah.
Perfect setup for the director, whoever set up the room for this. Excellent job by them. Mm-hmm. But as far as our key characters, I actually wrote down every single one of those reactions because I think that they're significant for each one of them. The first shot we get is actually of Margaery and Loras. Mm-hmm. Marjorie displays total shock, looking all over, doing the typical, oh my goodness, oh,
yeah.
I'm a woman, oh, there's a mouse, oh. Loras takes in a very deep breath, almost like he was expecting it to come to this, and it's like, well, here we go.
Yeah, he knows this whole thing is bullshit. I mean, I think they both do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Shay, looking incredibly worried. I mean, I think she realizes the gravity of the situation that she just created from everything she did there.
Yeah.
We get the look of Oberyn, who ears get kind of peaked, and he gets this look of,
he moves forward. He actually he's leaning back, and then he, like, moves forward as if he's, like,
he's very interested. Like, oh, this is getting interesting
now.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, this is my kind of trial now.
Yeah.
Jaime gets this look of disappointment, because after everything that he just did,
yeah, he's just like, Tyrion, oh, shit. Because Jamie's now worried, because he came up with an idea, at least in the show, he came up with this idea, or, you know, he thinks he did, but really it's like kind of Tywin's idea.
But so he made the sacrifice.
He did. Yeah. Yeah. Jamie really went out of his way in order to do this, because he's like the only one who loves his brother. And now, you know, before Tyrion's fate was sealed and he ensured that he would be alive, now, if there is a trial by combat and the person fighting for Tyrion loses, then Tyrion's dead. So Jaime is worried.
We get Cersei's face, who gets this look of looking beaten.
Yeah.
Which I think is very obvious, because she set up this whole thing and now it's all for naught.
Yeah,
like, now it's just all thrown away.
Yeah, because she's on the opposite end of Jaime, where she feels like, oh, if Tyrion's champion wins, then I'm fucked. He gets to live.
She thought she had everything figured out. Yep. And once again, like we say, she thinks she has it figured out, but really, she's not as smart as she thinks she is.
Yeah, exactly. Just like I said, she thinks she's Tywin with a dick, but she's not.
Lastly, we get a shot of Tyrion, which I'm not sure every time I see it, but it looks like he cracks a tiny smile on this one of the shots they have there.
Yeah, because he knows that this is all orchestrated against him, and now he knows he's fucking with their plans. So this is his only way of having any salvation, basically.
And we end with Tyrion and Tywin locking eyes in a cold stare and fade to black. And that's the end of our episode for this week, leaving it on one of the heaviest cases of blue balls
ever,
I think. We talked about how that Battle of Marine ended way too early. It's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Show me what happens next.
Yeah.
Excellent speech by Peter Dinklage on this.
Yes.
Phenomenal, phenomenal acting, John. I mean, I've watched that speech, I have to think, like maybe 20 times now.
Yeah.
And I still just get goosebumps every single time I watch it. Pound for pound, Peter Dinklage, best actor of all time.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and throw that out there.
He's good. Yeah, he's good.
It's kind of like the most respectful midget joke I'm going to be able to make. So, talking about this trial by combat, I'm trying to think of where this is going to go from here. Because, obviously, I mean, they do have the option to fight for themselves, right?
Yeah, but obviously that's not going to happen.
No, that's especially with noble people.
Especially
that's not the way they handle
Cersei,
it.
Cersei, yeah, just no.
So, trying to figure out who their champions are going to be. I have a short list.
Okay.
I want to go down. The first one would be Oberyn in the Mountain. I could see Tyrion with his little bit of a friendship he's been making with Oberyn, picking him. Lannisters, their tie with the Mountain, would pick him.
Yeah.
We do know that there's an episode coming up titled The Mountain and the Viper. We know that they have this big history. This would be kind of like tying up two ends with one story.
Mm.
So, I don't know. Seems like that would be a good option for them to go with, but
when you make that kind of case and you put it that way, it seems irrefutable, but you never know.
No, you never know. Like I said, I have other ones here. That's just why I put that one first. This is the one that seems to have the most backing.
And I mean, the Lannisters would be stupid not to pick the Mountain because he's known for being the biggest, baddest badass.
In our preview that we see for next week, we see the Mountain walking around with no armor on. Oh my goodness, this guy looks like he's gonna explode.
Are you sure that's the Mountain?
It's gotta be the Mountain.
I'm not certain about that.
Why?
Because I don't remember him being the same actor.
He's not the same actor.
No, but I mean, like,
he's been recast. He's been recast twice.
He's been recast twice. No, I got a different impression about who that was, but I won't. I guess we'll just like find out.
Okay.
If that's true or not, but I didn't get the impression that that was the Mountain, but it could very well be.
All
actually, now that I think about it, it you know, it could have been. But anyway, you know,
that doesn't significant to this anyway.
Yeah, and
regardless,
so
the Mountain
anyway,
is going to be a big person because he's called the Mountain. So yeah,
exactly.
Whoever he is,
yeah, he hasn't really shown up that much so far. So you know, like you said, it would be perfectly plausible if it were Oberyn Martell versus the Mountain because Oberyn Martell is there for revenge, and he made that clear already. In the books, by this point, it's not clear that Oberyn is. It's not that clear that he's there for revenge for that express purpose.
So that whole little side speech that him and Tyrion had, that never happens.
Okay. Not like that. Not really like that. He's not saying like, yeah, basically I'm here to kill the Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Like he is in the show. In the show, he's just like, that he makes it known. In the books, I feel like that's either revealed later or it's a bit more subtle than that because I didn't get that impression right away.
One of the other ones I had here was Tyrion picking Jaime because that's his brother. That's who he picked on the original time that he was in a trial by combat. And I could see the Lannisters just having Tywin go in there. And this whole situation, seeing Tywin be like, well, you know what? I'm just going to take control of the situation myself. Like maybe even if it's just a decision made emotionally because of what had went down there, I could see him stepping up and grabbing his sword and be like, all right, let's do this.
Even if one of them is involved, I don't think that it's realistic to expect that both of them would be involved because that is Tywin's heir. So one of them may be involved, but I would have to say that it doesn't seem realistic to expect that they would be fighting against each other. Because Tywin, you know, wants his heir still. He still, no matter what, wants
Jaime to be his heir. He does, but he's also could be frustrated with all the times that Jaime has let him down. And he could finally
He's too rational for that.
Okay.
He would never let his anger. I mean, he's already, if he's going to be upset about that, he should be, he's already upset about the fact that Jaime totally screwed him over by joining the Kingsguard. So it doesn't fit his character. So.
Now, this is the one I saved for last, because this is the one I think is the one that's going to be the most complex to it. Because I think this could be picked either way. And that would be Jaime versus Bronn. And I think either side could pick either one of those. I think you know, Tyrion could pick Jaime because that's the one person he feels like is on his side. Mm-hmm. He could also pick Bronn because that's the guy he's hired all these times.
And then Cersei could pick Jaime.
Jaime because that's, you know, he's a Lannister. Of course he's going to be there. And they could pick Bronn because, hey, we caught this guy and we know that he's on your side. Well, if we can pay him off or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Bronn has said many times he's a sellsword. He works for money.
He works for money. And on top of that, Bronn and Jaime have been, well, Bronn has been helping Jaime practice his
Which I think would be very appropriate if they end up going into this trial by combat. They know each other's tricks. They've been practicing all this time. They've been talking about how, like, we're going to use these fake swords because if we used real ones, I would be slicing you up.
Yeah, that's entirely true. And like you said, either side could choose either one of them because Bronn can be bought. Bronn is also Tyrion's sellsword. Mm-hmm. And Jaime could vie for his brother, or Jaime could be manipulated by his family. So that's a realistic choice, I'd say.
I really tried to wrap my head around other ones. I couldn't come up with anything other than introducing new characters or someone insignificant, like just maybe bringing Meryn fucking Trant into it or something. But
yeah, I don't think that they would. I don't think that the Lannisters would champion Meryn Trant because he's just kind of like unreliable and low in character and not that good of a swordsman, as the Hound pointed out. Mm-hmm. You're kind of limited to those people. The Mountain, I feel like, if you're going just for brute force, is the choice.
Yeah.
But I don't think that Tywin would want to champion Jaime because that's his heir.
I think that he would want to keep him out of it as much as he possibly could.
Yeah. Yes, I think that too, but you could have Cersei manipulating him somehow, or, you know, whatever. Something could happen like that. Or he could want to champion Tyrion, and then that would be a stab in Tywin's face, basically. Mm-hmm. So any of those things are possible.
Because then, you know, let's say Jaime loses. If Jaime loses and then Tyrion gets killed, then that's it. They're both dead.
Yeah, exactly. That is true. I have a question for you then.
Okay.
If it's not the Mountain and Oberyn Martell, what do you think that the title of the next episode is referring to? Like, what?
Well, that's not that's not the next episode. It's actually two episodes from now.
It's two episodes from now.
The next episode is actually titled Mockingbird.
Oh. Well, you know whose sigil is the Mockingbird. That's
Littlefinger.
Yeah, Littlefinger. Yeah. Okay. But even then, the Mountain and the Viper, so I guess it's not like...
It's going to take time to get this trial by combat set up, so that makes sense. You know, the next episode, focus a little more on Littlefinger, get his story in there, and then have little interstitials of
but
what's
at
going
the very
on with the
least, But at the very least, you have a hint now because of the name.
So I'm sorry, what was your question again?
No, just that you are getting a hint at least that the Mountain and the Red Viper, Oberyn Martell, are going to have some sort of significant...
showdown?
Not necessarily even a showdown, but there might be some sort of significant plot happening with them in the near future.
Okay.
It won't necessarily be a showdown.
Okay.
But anyway.
So you asked me what I think is going to happen between those
two? I'm just asking you, like if you're thinking about the name of that episode, basically.
Well, it definitely means that those two are going to meet. As far as what capacity of the meeting is going to be, I would assume that there's going to be some kind of physical lashing between the two. Whether that results in a death, I don't know. I think we're pretty sure that even though Tywin denied having anything to do with it, that he absolutely did.
Oh, he did.
I don't think there's anything being concerned.
Yeah,
maybe as Oberyn meets with the Mountain, he can uncover that truth more. Mm-hmm. Maybe even sway the Mountain onto his side. I don't know. That's something
that
could always
happen.
I kind of doubt that because the Mountain has always been portrayed as a really ruthless asshole. But...
yeah, he is. Again, in the books, I think I mentioned this when I talked about Robert's Rebellion, but when Robert Baratheon took the throne, the Mountain basically... Robert Baratheon didn't have a hand in this, but Tywin did his dirty work by ordering the Mountain to go mm-hmm. and kill anyone who threatened his claim, including Rhaegar and his children.
Mm-hmm.
So you do know that it's explicitly Tywin, by the way.
Even just by going by what you're seeing in the show, though.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's obvious, and Oberyn is kind of like vying his time, and he knows that he can't go for Tywin, but he might seek the opportunity to go against the Mountain.
I don't know. Once again, this has just left me with complete blue balls.
Yeah.
Definitely well done with everything they've done with this, though. I think this was an excellent trial.
I've been waiting for
the next step.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add about the trial or this episode?
No. Some of the previews were interesting. I don't know if you took notes about those.
I didn't take notes on those.
I can't remember.
I know we saw the big muscly guy swinging a sword at
something. Yeah, I don't know who that is. Bloody.
That's the guy I think is the Mountain, but who knows? I guess it could be somebody else. We see some stuff with Littlefinger. There's a part where it looks like Liza is holding Sansa over an edge, calling her a liar or some shit.
Yeah, okay, wait, so that's interesting. Sansa is building this snow castle, and Littlefinger comes up and starts talking to her, and you see Lysa holding Sansa over the moon door and calling her a liar. I mean, that's a pretty intense scene. I'm interested.
I'm guessing the whole castle that she's building is just her missing Winterfell.
I mean, you'll see when we get to it, but she's actually built, it's funny that you say that, because the castle is actually her building Winterfell. She's actually creating this elaborate snow castle of Winterfell, like the whole city. I mean, we'll see when we get there, but she even makes like the greenhouse that they use to make food, because it's cold up there, and or grow food, but rather.
Right.
Not make food. Greenhouses don't
and
make
then,
food.
And then I imagine, like, over on the side, she made a little snow lemon cake hut. Probably, she can remember her other favorite place to be. Who else did we not see this week? We said we didn't see Bran and crew. We did not see the Lady Melisandre.
No,
we
I'm disappointed.
Finally saw some of the Greyjoys. We didn't see Balin, though. You know who I realized we haven't seen in a long time is Walder Frey.
I know.
The heck is going on with that guy? I guess there's no one else. Lady Brienne and Podrick. We didn't see what's going on with those two.
Yeah, there's some people that you haven't met yet either.
Well, that we're not going to know we're missing them.
Yeah. No, I know. But I just mean, like, you've met Oberyn Martell. You haven't met anyone in his family.
No, the Martell's supposed to be a very big house, too, I believe.
Yeah. And they're, they're a royal family, you know.
Really, we haven't seen anything of Dorne.
No, you have not. You haven't even seen Dorne. No, I'm really interested to see when they get to Dorne. I was really interested to see Oberyn and his paramour Ilaria too. And I really love their characters. And in the books, unfortunately, there aren't like as many details about them. You know, it's like
I think it's kind of good to keep them a little more mysterious, though.
Yeah, in the show. In the show, I think they're perfect. I really like them. I really like their
It's
characters.
A lot of the actors, I think, on that, though. I think if they were played by anybody else, I don't know if I would like these characters as much. But
yeah, they're awesome.
Indira Varma and the Chilean guy who's playing Oberyn are just awesome.
Yeah, they're good. Even little details like their costumes. I know like most people are not
thinking about
their costumes.
Oh, that yellow robe that he's wearing is so cool. And only on him. If I wore that, I would look terrible. But he rocks it.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, I know that most people are not, like, thinking about his costume, but I think that all the costumes
in the
show...
That's a huge detail of the show.
Oh, my God. I love the costumes in the show. I mean, you know my love affair with the costumes and the embroidery. And all the little details. I mean, even when Joffrey was having his wedding, he had a crown that had antlers like House Baratheon and little roses woven into it. And, you know,
I did notice
just
that.
Cool
it was
things
cool.
like that. Yeah. And, anyway, so, you know, I like to see his character come to life because I love his character. And in the books, you don't get to see that about him very much. But, you know, I like that they give his character life on the show.
All right. Well, I guess with that, we are going to wrap things up talking about season 4, episode 6, The Laws of Gods and Men. And until next time, I am Heil Snow.
And I'm Jade Sand.
And this has been the Sand and Snow Podcast. We'll see y'all next time. Stay dragony. You just listened to the Sand and Snow Podcast. A Game of Thrones podcast covering all the weekly goings-ons in the world of Westeros and beyond. If you've enjoyed the show, receive every episode automatically by subscribing to us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio with your iOS or Android device. We are also proud to be available as part of FanboysAnonymous.com and MegapowersRadio.com. Please support all the other great content available on both of those networks. If you would like to communicate with us, please do so by liking us on Facebook at facebook.com/sandandsnowpodcast, on Twitter at sandandsnowpod, or by emailing us at sandandsnow@megapowersradio.com. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see y'all next time on the Sand and Snow Podcast.